Cheers, thanks, Clem. Cheers for everyone to, you know, coming in and listening to this. Okay, basically, in this paper, I want to examine the work of the Guyanese novelist Wilson Harris, focusing in particular on the radically utopian vision of social and cultural transformation found in his The Guyana Quartet. As people here, I'm sure, know, this tetralogy comprises four novels, Palace of the Peacock, The Far Journey of Udin, The Whole Armour, and The Secret Ladder, novels which were published in successive years from 1960 through to 1963. And I want to look at how Harris, as much through form as through content, articulates a conception of collectivity that aims to overcome the divisions that scar the Guyanese body politic, divisions rooted in the legacies of colonialism and imperialism, and bound up with the effects of economic underdevelopment, foreign intervention in political affairs, and ethnic conflict. So insofar as this paper touches on Indo-Caribbean themes, therefore, it's really in this kind of general sense of Harris's attempt to articulate a vision of wholeness that can obviously be seen as a response to and a desire to transcend the persistent tensions between Afro and Indo-Guyanese. Okay, so Harris's challenging and experimental texts have obviously been the focus of much debate. There's been a tendency, however, and this kind of chimes with something Malachi was saying about Naipaul, there's been a tendency for some critics to view Harris's work as very singular, as sui generis, as kind of, you know, completely out there on its own. An approach exemplified by Andrew Bundy in the introduction to his own edited collection of Harris's essays. Commenting on the author's emigration to England in 1959 and the contemporary boom in Caribbean writing, Bundy remarks that, quote, "Literary London published and created an international forum for West Indian writers at a time when there was not a single serious publisher in the Caribbean. Yet," Bundy goes on, "it would be misleading to view Harris as part of those movements. Harris's study of the fabric of the imagination sets his writing apart from the concerns of West Indian Caribbean writers." Okay, so that's Bundy's view. The claim that Harris did not form part of those movements associated with Caribbean writers in London seems something of an overstatement given his involvement in projects such as the Caribbean Artists Movement. Moreover, in suggesting that his fictional concerns diverge markedly from those of other Caribbean writers, Bundy appears implicitly to want to abstract Harris's work from its concrete social context in favour of emphasising the author's personal vision. Indeed, Bundy's emphasis in the introduction is very much on the mythical, even mystical qualities of Harris's work. In this sense, Bundy's perspective shares something with the myth that, as Gregory Shaw has observed, has built up around Harris as, quote, "a writer who ventured into the South American heartland, experienced a special vision of some sort, and returned to tell the world." Shaw goes on to suggest that some critics assume that the, quote, "unique experience and vision are sufficient justification for a shockingly experimental style." While it's undoubtedly true that Harris's experiences as a land surveyor in the Guyanese interior have had a profound impact upon his fiction, and that his style is highly distinctive, as anyone who's read his work will know, his concerns do not seem contrabandy all that far away from those of a number of his contemporaries, and in fact become more understandable when considered in relation to work by the latter. Similarly, while Harris's novels tend towards abstraction, close attention to the historical context in which they appeared provides a deeper understanding of their formal qualities than does the emphasis purely on their being the product of a special vision. Indeed, not only can the texts that comprise the Guyana Quartet be seen as registering thematically the social issues confronting Guyana in the 1960s, it's also possible to understand their shockingly experimental style as the translation into the logic of the literary field of the particular forces prevalent in the Guyanese political field since the 1950s. As James Millett has argued, the decolonisation process in Guyana was different from that occurring in any other British West Indian colony, with the Marxist-Leninist People's Progressive Party, dominated by the Indo-Guyanese Chedi Jagan and the Afro-Guyanese Forbes Burnham, articulating from its very founding a consistently radical political programme. And Millett explains, "On nearly all the major issues of the day, Guyana, in the era of PPP-dominated administrations, had a different point of view. In a very short space of time, it distanced itself from those parties whose principal goal was what has been called constitutional decolonisation. In all the other colonies, the objectives of the decolonisation movement were understated so as to embrace political, but not ideological or economic decolonisation. In Guyana, political decolonisation was a stage, even if an important first stage, in the radical transformation of society." Millett suggests that the radical views of the PPP were ultimately those which large numbers of people were espousing in the post-independence Caribbean as early as 1955, as the limitations of constitutionalist decolonisation became apparent, and too as the Cuban Revolution seemed to offer an alternative path. Harris's formal radicalism could, in this light, be seen as the result of the mediation within the literary object of the more radical social and political project that was the focus of struggle in Guyana. The increase in recognition that meaningful freedom would have to involve more thoroughgoing decolonisation of institutions and habits becomes Harris's attempt to explode the conventions of what he identifies as traditional realism. This particular mediation of the political in the literary can be discerned in Palace of the Peacock. The multiracial boat crew, whose journey upstream into the Guyanese interior the novel recounts, stand as an allegory for Guyana's ethnically diverse populace, although, as Jeremy Poynting has pointed out, the East Indian component is missing in that novel, and this community is then treated separately in The Far Journey of Udin. The divisions between the crew and the absence of an East Indian are suggestive of the racial tensions that had come to the fore since the mid-20th century. In 1953, national elections saw Jagan's PPP win a majority of seats on the Legislative Council, only to be forced from power 133 days later by the British government. With Cold War anxieties sharpening, both Britain and the US were wary of what they perceived to be a communist takeover. They set out to eradicate the PPP, Britain instigating a divide-and-rule process through the Robertson Commission of Inquiry, and the US deploying the CIA to cultivate racial division. By the end of the decade, the PPP had split into two opposing parties, as was mentioned a few times in some of the talks yesterday. Obviously, you ended up with Jagan's PPP drawing the majority of its support from the Indo-Guyanese community, and then Burnham's PNC, which was backed mainly by the Afro-Guyanese community. This ethnic polarisation intensified to the point that between 1962 and 1964, obviously, you know, these are the years that Harris is writing the Guyana Quartet, during those years the country suffered what Perry Mars has called a spate of ethno-political hostilities involving near-genocidal warfare between East Indian and African politicised communities. Set against this backdrop, the emphasis in Palace of the Peacock, indeed in all the novels of the Quartet, on the establishment of cross-cultural community clearly resonates with a desire to see the resolution of the enmities plaguing the body politic. The final vision of the crew, resurrected into a new apprehension of themselves and of their entwined histories, which is kind of described in this way in the novel, quote, "I felt the faces before me begin to fade and part company from me and from themselves as if our need of one another was now fulfilled, and our distance from each other was the distance of sacrament, the sacrament and embrace we knew in one muse and one undying soul." Okay, so this final vision appears as a kind of utopian figure for the lineaments of a future independent nation state. However, the extreme otherworldly character of this vision underscores the extent to which the transformations necessary to reconstruct the social world. The novel suggests, moreover, that such a reconstruction of the present requires also a rethinking of the past. Evoking a range of periods from Guyanese history, the narrative demonstrates how eclipsed perspectives must be unearthed. How can one begin to reconcile the broken parts of such an enormous heritage, asks Harris in an essay of the multiple legacies present in the Caribbean. The declaration at the end of Palace of the Peacock that the crew, quote, had all come home at last to the compassion and the nameless unflinching folk is the signal that such a reconciliation has been achieved here. This return to the folk, though, should not be construed as a return to a kind of retrograde nativism or an immutable past. Rather, it represents what Edward Gleeson terms a return to the point of entanglement from which we were forcibly turned away. That is where we must ultimately put to work the forces of creolisation or perish. The point of entanglement for Gleeson, as much as for Harris, is the point of contact between diverse histories and modes of existence. It is a dynamic, conflictual site. Gleeson calls it the point where our problems lie in wait for us, while Harris views it as simultaneously the problem, the colonial conquest, for example, and as containing within itself the seeds of a radically different future to the one that was materialised under imperialism. It's this unfulfilled potential, a potential Harris elsewhere refers to as a phenomenal legacy, that is represented by the folk in Palace of the Peacock, and which it is therefore necessary to uncover in order to rethink history. As a past that did not come to fruition, it must be brought into and concretised in the present so as to transform the future. The promise Harris locates in this unfinished past is to reiterate that of cross-cultural community, or what he calls cross-cultural community. The way in which he inscribes cultural heterogeneity and the imbrication of historical legacies into his writing is well documented, and I'm not going to go on about that here. Instead, what interests me in particular is the connection between these concerns and the issue of the state, specifically the groundwork necessary to effect its total reorganisation. Now, there's been a real tendency for Harris's work to be considered from a perspective that shares much with the kinds of approaches that have been to the fore in the field of post-colonial studies, including an idealist emphasis on hybridity as inherently subversive and emancipatory, as being able to undo the power relations of colonialism through its very exposure of their ambivalence, an ambivalence that's considered to have always already been at work in such power relations, so that their overthrow is really no more than the revelation of what they were all along. Clearly, elements of Harris's theoretical and literary production do lend themselves to this incredibly problematic sort of post-structuralist inflected understanding. It wouldn't be hard, for instance, to elaborate a reading of the vision of cross-culturality that climaxes Palace of the Peacock as the exposure of the inherent ambivalence, to use that kind of post-colonial catchword, of the colonizer-colonized dyad. I want to suggest, however, that it's possible to offer a more materially grounded take on Harris's return to the point of entanglement and the image of liberation he proffers. By portraying the stripping away over the course of 7 days of the crew's habits and frames of perception, Palace of the Peacock narrates a kind of reverse creation myth. The significance of going back to a moment of genesis in this way, at least in terms of how Harris's novel might be said to register the political struggles in Guyana in the 1950s and 60s, becomes evident if we consider the process by which the state naturalizes the particular organization of the social world it imposes. Pierre Bourdieu, he of Habitus fame, contends that if the state, quote, is able to exert symbolic violence, it's because it incarnates itself simultaneously in objectivity, in the form of specific organizational structures and mechanisms, and in subjectivity, in the form of mental structures and categories of perception and thought, so, which would be the habitus. By realizing itself in social structures and in the mental structures adapted to them, the instituted institution makes us forget that it issues out of a long series of acts of institution in the active sense, and hence has all the appearances of the natural. So basically, it's the kind of, you know, the naturalization of state power and the adaptation of people's bodily habitus to the objective forms they find around the kind of economic and institutional structures. Bourdieu then goes on to note that, quote, this is why there is no more potent tool for rupture than the reconstruction of genesis. By bringing back into view the conflicts and confrontations of the early beginnings and therefore all the discarded possibilities, it retrieves the possibility that things could and still could be otherwise. And through such a practical utopia, it questions the possible, which, among all others, was actualized. Okay, so like Bourdieu's practical utopia then, that by reconstructing the moment of genesis denaturalizes these categories, Harris's text staged the utopian rupture of that adjustment between mental and objective structures. When the crewman vigilance in Palace recognises, quote, the enormous spiritual distance and inner bleeding substance that lay between himself and that crust and shell he had once thought he inhabited, it suggests the sloughing off of the bodily and perceptual dispositions with which he had been inculcated. As the dominant principles of vision and division disintegrate, the instituted objective structures which govern the organisation and apprehension of space and time lose their appearance of immutability. With the interrelated breakdown of the bodily habitus and the givenness of the ruling space-time conventions comes a new understanding of the social and cultural relations that bind the crew together. Introducing what will become a recurrent Harrisian motif, the novel shows the boundaries that separate the crew into isolated individuals collapsing so that subjectivities become extended concertina-like through other subjectivities. The monstrous thought came to them, the novel puts it, that they had been shattered and were reflected again in each other at the bottom of the stream. This recognition of mutuality is inextricable from the attempt to narrate beyond the horizon of rarefied mental and social structures, beyond the horizon of a particular habitus imbricated in the organization of a particular type of state. So to narrate beyond this to a point of genesis wherein other forms are still possible, and in that way are intimated the relations between individuals and between individuals and the world that would have to be institutionalized to sustain a different form of community. Okay, so despite the undeniably metaphysical tendency in Harris's thought then, his approach does implicate issues connected to the social and institutional aspects of the decolonization process. And in that respect, it's kind of it's interesting to note the characteristics shared by the concepts that underwrite Palace of the Peacock with the political thinking behind certain Caribbean subaltern anti-colonial movements. If you take, for example, Claudius Henry in the African Reform Church, an organisation active in Jamaica in the late 1950s and 60s, having worked with Edna Fisher to build up the church, the doctrine of which combined elements of Rastafarian ideas with new rituals, Henry attempted to stage a rebellion against the colonial state in Jamaica. According to Anthony Bogues, Henry's politics were the politics of dread. Drawing on the black redemptive tradition, they displayed that tradition's distinctive emphasis on the making of God into a human. For this reason, contends Bogues, Henry did not, quote, operate a conception of God in history as a form of providential design. Instead, biblical texts served only as codes, as reference and sources for his human agency, not as commands. While Henry's nationalism was ultimately focused on Africa, there are clear affinities, I think, between his prophetic redemptive standpoint and Harris's own articulation of the redemption of history, his bringing of an unfinished past into the present to serve as an image for a future to be actualized in the now. Both would seem to be influenced by the notion of temporality characteristic of medieval Christianity, wherein simultaneity related to the convergence of past and future in an instantaneous present, in a prophetic notion of scriptural eternity. Palace of the Peacock offers something like a secularized version of this in its final sequence, in which the past of the folk, in the sense that they represent this kind of unfulfilled historical potential, converges in a present that is at the same time presented as the prophetic ground of the future. Though in contrast to Henry, the future Harris envisions is a Caribbean cross-cultural one rather than an African one. Moreover, further marking the radicalism of Henry's politics was the different temper of their anti-colonialism as compared to that which characterised the Creole nationalist movement, represented in Jamaica, of course, by Norman Manley's PNP. While the latter, notes Bogues, worked within the parameters of the colonial epistemic project, Henry and others challenged these orders. For the Creole nationalists, the space of the political was narrow and institutional. For Henry and others, it was ontological. In Henry's ideational framework, the life world of the African human was constructed by history. For displaced African people, the question was how to reorder that history and establish a new ground for African humanness. Again, for Harris, the question is how to establish a new ground for Caribbean humanness. Nevertheless, his work evinces a similar emphasis on the political space as ontological and not just institutional. Moreover, Henry's attempt to reground politics was inextricable from a challenge to the habitus associated with the black and brown bourgeoisie and adjusted to the type of constitutionally decolonized state Creole nationalists sought to institute. A habitus that kind of retained the impress of colonial frameworks. What both Henry's and Harris's perspectives share, then, is a concern with overthrowing such habitus in order to further social change. But of course, as I've implied, to concretize that change requires the concomitant reorganization of the state. And in that regard, Harris's vision at the end of Palace was, of course, far from being realized as he was writing it. And there seems to be a tacit recognition of this in The Secret Ladder, which is the last novel in the quartet, and one in which issues of the state are much more to the fore, and the utopianism of Palace of the Peacock has been somewhat tempered. In that novel, a government surveyor, Fenwick, travels up the Kanji River with his surveying team, and is again gradually brought to an apprehension of Guyana's cross-cultural heritage. And indeed, the book again works as a kind of reverse creation myth. It's again set over 7 days, and you again have this kind of transformation in perceptions and habitus and kind of ways of behaviour. However, instead of the collective rebirth that you get at the end of Palace, at the end of The Secret Ladder, it's Fenwick's expanded consciousness alone that forms the focal point of the novel's conclusion. Moreover, his newfound apprehension of community is already on its way to becoming a phenomenal legacy. Its promise is being resubmerged by events occurring around the Kanji, where a violent incident between Fenwick's foreman Weng and some of Poseidon's men leads to the latter mistakenly believing they've killed the former. And they then, as a result, flee and are then chased by Weng and his men and are basically fleeing from the state. And the novel kind of ultimately ends as it began, with a group of peasants and displaced peoples kind of fearing incursion by the state and fearing kind of authoritarian power structures. In that sense, the contrast between the utopian finale of Palace of the Peacock and the more pessimistic conclusion to The Secret Ladder would seem to register the change in situation in Guyana. Published in 1963, the later novel appeared at the very moment ethnic violence in the country was intensifying. The inability of the crew to overcome their divisions obviously speaks to this situation. Additionally, the way in which Fenwick's rule, which had been this kind of highly problematic rule of a bourgeois professional, is ultimately succeeded by Weng, who is kind of seen as of the people, but ends up being much more authoritarian, prefigures the kind of politics that would emerge out of the national crisis in Guyana. The threat of state violence against Poseidon's followers and the implication that Weng's ascent will mean the continuation of the policy of divide and rule seems to emphasise the continued problem of ethnic conflict and point forward to the difficulties that beset Guyana under the regime of Forbes Burnham. It would be wrong to read too much into this comparison. Obviously, you know, Burnham didn't come to power until 1964, but it's possible that Harris's novel is registering the ingrained structural problems that contributed to the rise of authoritarianism in Guyana. And I'll stop it there. Cheers.